The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, hosted by The Nation magazine and available wherever you can listen to podcasts. Last week, we took up the issue of the long-running monster dating back to the 1990s, of the debt ceiling, which is a weapon used by the Republicans to force Democratic presidents to make cuts under the threat of destroying the global economy. And we talked about with Jeff Hauser of the Revolving Door Project about various methods that the Biden administration could actually fight the debt ceiling itself, not just a political fight with the Republican Party, but to delegitimize this instrument, which I think there's a very compelling argument is like unconstitutional, makes no sense, and has to be gotten rid of just for the future governance of the United States. But the debt ceiling fight continues, and I think there's divisions within the Democratic Party about this. Joe Biden has kind of sent mixed signals, and to kind of talk about the actual, politics of this. I'm very happy to have on my old friend Brian Beutler of Crooked Media. He's an editor in chief there, and he runs the excellent newsletter Big Tent, which he writes for, which I will include in the show notes because it's one of the best sort of one-stop shopping places if you want to get a broad overview of the week's news. So Brian, thanks for being here.
It's great to be on with you.
Yeah. So I think let's start with the Biden White House itself. As I sort of indicated, there's a little bit of mixed signaling just in terms of Biden has actually, talked about the 14th Amendment as something he's like interested in, but perhaps just not now. What's your sense of where the Biden is on these negotiations?
I think that there were sort of fateful moments both at the beginning and now that we're nearing the end. At the end, as to the 14th Amendment, that's sort of a. I think that Joe Biden has this out, right? Like the Constitution basically says that the debt is inviolable, so that would render the debt limit statute itself unconstitutional. And he could just say there's no actual issue here. There's nothing for no leverage for Republicans to extort us with because the tool they're trying to use is actually just invalid. And then he could continue auctioning new debt and financing the deficit with that debt, and everything would be fine. He seems averse to doing it for reasons that I feel like misunderstand what his current predicament is and how the consequences of invoking the 14th Amendment would play out. He's worried, and I think he's right to be worried, that somebody would sue and say, no, actually, like your interpretation of the 14th Amendment is wrong. The debt limit statute is valid. You have to honor it. We should be in default right now. Let's go to the courts and have the justices, ultimately the Supreme Court justices, weigh in. And he needs a conflict for there to be a case in court, and then he needs the Supreme Court to find in his favor. And I think he's right to be suspicious that this Supreme Court isn't going to find in his favor, but he seems to want to have that fight sort of free and clear from the debt limit deadline, so that if the court rules against him, it doesn't instantly plunge the country into default on the debt. I think what he doesn't realize is that because the Supreme Court is filled with political actors, he should want them to be making that decision when the stakes of it are at the greatest. And that's now, basically. He should want to be in court basically right now. and he should want the Supreme Court to understand that if five of the Republican-appointed justices say, actually, no, the debt limit statute is valid and we are now in default and suddenly all this debt is invalid and you need to stop cutting checks to senior citizens, that's going to be on them. Everyone's going to realize that Republicans went to the Supreme Court, asked the Supreme Court to ruin the American economy, and the Supreme Court did it. And I think they're much less likely to do it under those circumstances. Instead, he's decided, well, since they're unlikely to rule in my favor, I better pay ransom to the GOP right now and then save that litigation for a safer time. And I think that's what's happening in his head. And that's sort of the advice that he's getting from his legal experts.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I mean, I think one way to think about it is that the dilemma Biden is facing is fight or flight. And, you know, fight being, you know, like, let's make a constitutional issue of this and let's make all the stakes very clear. And flight being like, well, let's negotiate with the GOP, make, you know, a few concessions we don't want, and let's save the fight for another day. And I think you sort of clarified like why it might be better to fight now. What do you think is it's worth maybe teasing out the like thinking behind the instinct of flight, the instinct of, you know, let's try to placate the Republicans, let's wait for another moment to have the fight. Like what do you think is like the underlying logic of that position?
I mean, I have certain misgivings, Big Tent readers will know, about the sort of quality of thinking in elite Democratic strategist ranks. And so I think that there's just like sort of broad spectrum conflict aversion that mm-hmm. may be playing a role. I also think that Biden is like a, you know, he's a faithful steward of the government. Even when I disagree with him, I don't presume that he's making his decisions without like applying basically decent judgment. And he is, I think, worried that Republicans genuinely would plunge the country into default, and that if he is unable to issue new debt, despite having hit the debt limit, it'll be catastrophic. It will be, you know, basically, I think something like 25% of all federal spending will have to shut off. And there will be a lot of pressure to service actual debt, you know, the Chinese government or investors that are owed debt payments by us. And that means that there will be huge cuts to veterans benefits, to border security, which is an important political issue right now, to senior citizens on Medicare and Social Security. And he doesn't want to put people through that, even if it's only brief. I also just don't think he anticipated being in this position. I think that he ended up with two sort of conflicting pieces of advice about how to deal with Republicans threatening to not lift the debt limit. The sort of catechism that I assumed Democrats were living under in the post-Obama era was no negotiation under any circumstances around the debt limit. Like, you can do whatever you want, you can say whatever you want, but we're not going to have a conversation. And one day, if you just refuse to raise it, the country will end up in default and everyone's going to know it's on you, because I'm here saying that's not negotiable. What you're threatening is something that is like negotiating with terrorists, and we're not going to do it. The other option was to play cute, right? And say, hey, if you want to have a negotiation about the budget, why don't you tell us the cuts that you want to make are? Show us your plan. And so Republicans did. They sent him a piece of legislation that raised the debt limit, but also had all these horrible cuts in it. And I think Democrats thought this is like a really great trick, because we're going to get to show the American people how unpopular the Republican agenda is. Except when you do that, you've validated the premise that you should be negotiating around the debt limit. So Republicans sent him their opening bid, and now you're in a negotiation that you said that you were never going to have. And it's hard to get out of it once you've said, well, the predicate for any kind of negotiation is you send me your plan first. Well, they did. They called his bluff. And now then he was in negotiations that I don't think he ever wanted to be in. And that left him kind of scrambling for an out. And I don't think he's found one.
Yeah. No, I do think he's kind of put himself in a very exposed position. And I think one thing that you brought out in your writing is that Biden's exposed position is making some Democrats in Congress more bold, that they're trying to, like, you know, perhaps create the spine that Biden isn't providing. And so we've seen some movement there, especially like in the Senate. And I think some interesting comments by AOC in terms of the House, in terms of and some movement in the House as well, in terms of like Democrats saying, like, you know, they won't help the Republicans, you know, get the votes that they need. So you want to like describe what the dynamics are in Congress?
Yeah. So I guess a good place to start is with the bill that I was just talking about, the Republicans passed, that included an increase in the debt limit. It also included a very right wing budget, basically a bunch of spending cuts to basically everything across the board that isn't military and isn't Social Security. And so that would be very onerous. It's full of unpopular stuff. Joe Biden celebrated when they sent it to him. He started, you know, tweeting about all the horrible unpopular things that Republicans are trying to force on the country. But they got 218 votes for it, right? So we know that there's 218 votes for that plan. But that plan can't pass the Senate. So it can't get out of Congress. The debt limit can't be raised. There's two alternatives to the Republican-only plan. One is just a clean debt limit increase. Congress just says, we're not going to attach anything to this. We're just going to increase the debt limit so we don't default. And that would also have to pass both the House and the Senate. The second option would be some kind of bipartisan deal, which is what Biden is negotiating now, where Democrats say, well, I guess we're going to have to surrender some concessions to Republicans in exchange for getting the debt limit increase. And the question is, which of those second two options is likelier to be able to clear both the House and the Senate? And what AOC was saying is that any deal that Kevin McCarthy strikes with Joe Biden is going to need a lot of Democratic votes to pass, because he's going to lose a bunch of extreme Republicans who only want to raise the debt limit if they get everything they want. And so he's going to have to come to Democrats begging. And so Democrats can just say, we're not going to be a part of that. We're like, we are not going to help you guys extort us. I think the only problem with that then is that, well, that only leaves you with the clean debt limit option. And we know that every Democrat in the House will vote for that, and probably every Democrat in the Senate too, but that's still, there's only like 213 votes. So you need five Republicans to agree. And I think the question is, in the pressure cooker of like you're approaching the deadline to increase the debt limit, and it's either you move on something or you default, what's likelier to pass both houses, the clean debt limit or the negotiated deal where Democrats agree that they are going to give Republicans some ransoms? And I don't honestly sit here know which of those two outcomes is more likely. But I think what AOC was saying is it's preemptive. If they come to us, if the White House comes to us saying we need your votes to help get this passed, that's essentially a form of caving, because we actually have more votes for a clean debt limit increase than Republicans have for any other viable plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's like trying to take use some leverage from the simple fact that Kevin McCarthy doesn't actually have control over his own party, that there's actually highly factionalized, and there might be divisions there. I actually think the larger point is, I'm actually not sure, like, when you're negotiating with Kevin McCarthy, who are you negotiating with exactly? It's unclear to me, like, if he has the votes for anything. I guess he does have the vote for, you know, the budget that they passed, but which Democrats would never accept, right? So
yes, he has is the votes. And the truth is, I'm not even sure he could get those 218 votes again if it was something that was likely to become law, because he only got the 218 votes by telling his own conference, don't worry about the details here. This is a negotiating position. This is an opening bid. We just need to get it past the House. We need to clear it. So just vote yes. That's how they whipped it.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the sort of Republicans in districts that Joe Biden won, if it was a up or down choice between that becoming law or not, would say, no, I don't actually want that to become law. And if given a chance to vote for it in the heat of the moment, I think they'd say no. So I'm not sure any of the options actually has 218 votes. But the clean debt limit option is so alluring because it's very close, 213. You just need five Republicans. What Democrats aren't certain they have is any kind of forcing mechanism to make five Republicans vote with the Democrats, because all of those Republicans will anticipate primary challenges. Marjorie Taylor Greene has already basically said that these will be dead men walking if they side with the Democrats on the debt limit. So when push comes to shove, it may just be that the only thing that will get the debt limit increased before the deadline is this surrender option that Joe Biden is currently negotiating.
Yeah. No, that seems like a very grim scenario. In terms of the Senate, like, do you think what weight would you give to the fact that we're seeing more and more members of the Senate like coming out in favor of the 14th amendment option? Like, is there can the Senate be a, you know, like a pressure point to push Biden on this?
It's more than a handful, but not much more that have signed on to that letter. I think secretly it's probably a few dozen who wish he would just obviate this whole mess by invoking the 14th Amendment. What I wrote in Big Tent, and I think is true, is that if Biden had his hands around this problem and he was going to get his party and the country through it without, well, you know, paying ransom to the GOP, without screwing it up somehow, this letter wouldn't have been necessary. The letter in and of its existence and the fact that we know about it is an indication that the Democrats who signed it are alarmed about where things stand, and think that if nothing intervenes to knock him off this trajectory, there's going to be some sort of caving to the GOP to negotiate around the debt limit after Democrats swore up and down that they would never do that again. I'm glad that the letter is out there, and I think it would be good if pressure built and more Democrats joined.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
But what you would really want to see is enough Democrats, like 41 Democrats, saying we won't vote for a debt limit where we are the only side conceding policy. And then it would be a really tough situation, because then Biden would know that no deal could get through the Senate. They would be filibustered and it would die. We haven't seen that. And so I don't think that it's likely to play out that way. Another thing that we haven't seen is that there is a parliamentary mechanism that Democrats could use to increase the debt limit in the Senate without a filibuster. So just 51 votes and it's done. It would run through the Budget Committee. The Budget Committee chairman is Sheldon Whitehouse. There's been no indication that they're exploring that as an option. And I assume that means they don't think that they would have 51 votes for a clean debt limit increase. So I, you know, it, the letter is a nice gesture, but it's really just a gesture at this point. The like the way we would know it if Senate Democrats were flexing their power enough to really alter the course of these negotiations, and we haven't seen it so far.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of in terms of a big picture take on this, I mean, I think one thing is like how Biden views politics, which I think is that he sees, as you mentioned, indicated earlier, his role is to be a steward, is to, you know, like you get elected and you govern and then you keep politics. The actual politics of political combat is for election time. And that's when you like sort of raise the salience of the differences between the two parties. And so the idea seems to be, you know, like we'll govern for now, you know, keep things under a stable, even keel. And then when it comes to election time, then, you know, we're going to raise all these terrible things that the Republicans have done. And conversely, I think the Republicans have a very different view of politics. They see politics as something that's happening all the time. It's like, mm-hmm. You know, like it's a 365 day political cycle, right? And that like, yeah, at every single moment, you're like leveraging for to push your agenda and also to push your message. So, I mean, any thoughts on that? Because I think that some of the comments you made about, you know, how they're hoping to, that some of the stuff that Donald Trump has said, hoping to use them at the election rather than now. Like, it seems that's in keeping with this idea, this divided view of politics, that politics is an election time thing.
Yeah, I mean, just as a general matter, I think that when you have a two-party system, if one of the parties has given itself over to pure partisan brawling 365 days a year, as you put it, you're kind of left no choice. You should start to operate in the same way because it's a two-party system. So politics is very zero sum, and whatever you lose is their gain. And so if they're kicking your butt around for say 300 of the 365 days, and then in the last 65, you start to campaign, well, I mean, maybe you win the election, but what have you conceded along the way to people who are taking things hostage and making demands and trying to make everything dysfunctional constantly? You are hobbling yourself by not responding to their provocations. And Republicans are just provocateurs at this point, almost exclusively. So there's the general issue. As it pertains to the debt limit situation right now, I think what I would tell Biden if he asked me is that in this case there's no tension. The question of whether Republicans are allowed controlling one half of one branch of government, of the elected branches of government, to hold the whole system hostage until they get exactly what they demand, or only what they demand and no horse trading, no give and take. Like that's an affront to the constitutional system, and defeating it is not just good politics, but it's part of what governing is. It's part of being faithful to your oath, is not letting them warp the constitutional system in that way. And if you're worried about it going to a corrupt Supreme Court, well, then what you're saying is you know that the Supreme Court is corrupt, and that is also an urgent constitutional emergency that you have a stake in and you have a responsibility to address at some level. And so you should be, you know, if not like eager and happy to have this fight with the Supreme Court, then resolved to, because it's your obligation not to let Republicans with control of the House and five Supreme Court justices in their pockets to overturn the will of voters in the 2018, 2020, and 2022 elections. That's crazy. And assuming that just because it's confrontational and partisan to do it that way, that means it's only political and it's not a governing issue, is a very crimped view of governing, particularly in the Trump era, right? In the modern polarized hyper-partisan GOP era. Like governing now isn't just budgets and health policy and prescription drug prices. It's, do we have any semblance of a functioning democracy anymore? And if you give into this, then you're kind of saying, nah, I guess we lose. And I mean, I don't think that that's very good governance. I think that's a good basis for somebody to say, wait, we need somebody new at the top of the party.
Well, I was actually going to get to that, because I think that, I mean, Biden's is running for re-election. And I think he has a lot of goodwill, just based on the fact that I think he achieved, you know, a real substantial legacy just in the first 2 years. And the Democrats overperformed in the midterms. And so, you know, like just a couple of months ago, I felt that Biden's position within the party is like unassailable. You know, there are concerns about his age, which are natural and real, but you know, like given what he's achieved, I didn't see any path to like any sort of challenges. But like how does it all open up more, you know, doubts about Biden as the leader of the party, the standard bearer of the party?
Yeah, I want to distinguish between should and will, because I, you know, it's a little late in the game. And
yeah, it's unlikely to
the reason I think that this is at least theoretically a breaking point moment, or people in the Democratic Party might want to think about it that way, is based on what you said before, is that prior to getting ensnared in another debt limit hostage situation and seemingly being on the cusp of making concessions in order to get the debt limit increased, there was just very thin grounds for arguing that Biden should be primaried, because he'd governed successfully with tiny majorities in 2021 and 2022. And then he, you know, the midterms went much better for Democrats than even most Democrats expected. So other than like a crank like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, you're not going to get like a credible Democrat to say, look, I want to continue what Biden has started, but I'm just younger and you don't have to worry about me keeling over and dying. So let's switch him out with me. Like, that's a really tough sell. And I understand why no Democrat wanted to go out there and make that pitch, because it would have been a losing pitch and it would have been, you know, basically the end of the line for you, probably in Democratic politics, at least for a long time. I think that this mistake that seems to be that Biden seems to be in the process of making changes things, because now there's a genuine like bone of contention for a credible Democrat, if a credible Democrat wanted to make it, could offer, is I understand Republicans better than Joe Biden does. Joe Biden's still laboring under some misapprehensions about Republicans that he's carried with him for 50 years. Republicans aren't like that anymore. I wouldn't have gotten us into this mistake. I've been on to Republicans since they started doing this 12 years ago. And fundamentally, the party just needs leaders who are willing to accept Republicans as what they are and fight them on that basis. And that's me, not Joe Biden. I think that that's a genuinely like reasonable pitch for somebody who wanted to be president to make, if they wanted to assemble the team and the money and roll the dice. It's not frivolous. It's not nonsense. You know, that doesn't mean that I think it's going to happen. But I think that I guess what I should say is I think rank and file Democrats should be upset enough about what's happening right now to start pondering that.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I'm glad you zeroed in on this issue of like Biden's views of the Republicans, because I think that does get to some of the heart of the matter. And it seems like he has a divided view of Republicans, that there's a part of Joe Biden that's very aware of everything that's happened under Trump and January 6th and afterwards, and, you know, sees Republicans as an existential threat to American democracy. And that's the Joe Biden that, you know, talks about MAGA Republicans. And that's the Joe Biden that like gave very effective speeches right before the midterms, basically elevating the issue of democracy and making clear that democracy is on the line. But that's like half of his view of the Republicans. There's also another Joe Biden that's, you know, been in a politics, national politics since the 70s, has nostalgic memories of, you know, well, when he could work with Bush Sr. On the America with Disabilities Act and other things, and, you know, like, can find common ground with some Republicans to make changes and, you know, really wants that world back. And so it seems like Biden is, you know, toggles back and forth between those two views of the Republican Party, between what he wants a Republican Party to be and what he actually knows it to be.
I agree, except I have a slightly different interpretation of the same set of facts. I don't think Joe Biden is ambivalent about Republicans and isn't certain whether they're good or bad or a little bit of both. I think that he realizes that that the Republican Party of today should not be trusted with power, and that he thinks I'm sure he thinks Donald Trump is just an atrocious person, and the party's remade itself in his image, and that is inexcusable. But I think that he and many Democrats believe it is their responsibility in some sense to try to save Republicans from themselves, to pick out the good ones, praise them for not being like full MAGA Republicans, hope that you can kind of get something going with that faction so that the country can see, including, you know, Republican voters can see that the sort of extremist faction that now controls the party is a dead end and there's just a better way. And I think a more current and savvier view of things is that you actually just need to beat the party every single time and not give quarter to any faction of it until they decide that it's in their interest to change themselves. And, you know, there was a ribbon cutting ceremony of some kind recently, and Biden was there, and it was in a Republican, like a quote unquote moderate Republicans district. I think it was Mike Lawler. And, you know, Biden starts praising the guy. He's not one of those MAGA guys. I shouldn't say much. I don't want to get him into trouble, but he's like, he reminds me of the Republicans that I could work with. And even if in part of Biden thinks that's true, it's a mistake to volunteer it. Like, what has Mike Lawler done to deserve that? He has the same exact position on the debt limit as Donald Trump. He's currently trying to mug Joe Biden, and Biden's here praising him. And I think that the solution, I think it's totally fine to wish for a Republican Party that you could deal with on a good faith, upright basis, but you have to realize that this isn't that party. And so you just got to beat it and not try to hive off the elements of it that you think are good. Because when push comes to shove, they're with Trump. They're not with Biden.
Yeah, no, that's I think that's right. And we aren't quite there with Biden having that sort of clarity. But I think, you know, when we're talking about where this leaves Biden's position in the party, I think that the next Democratic leader, whoever they will be, is, you know, likely to, you know, have a much clearer, more forthright view of the Republicans and try to, like, you know, see the advantages of making partisan divide more clear. Like, I think that's clearly where the party is going, even if Biden isn't there yet.
I think that's right. I mean, I think you see it in, you know, it's not really a primary challenge because she became an independent, but Ruben Gallego is running against Kyrsten Sinema for Senate in Arizona. She's one of these dead end filibuster supporters. He is not. Basically, I don't see in the near future any Democratic primary candidate winning the nomination without being, for instance, against without being for abolishing the filibuster, right? And so all the Senate Democrats who did well in 2022 are like filibuster abolitionists, and that represents the party moving in this direction, you know, even faster than Biden has. And I think that that's part and parcel of what you're talking about, is that when next time there is a competitive Democratic presidential primary, it won't be like in 2020 when there was mixed opinions about the filibuster and mixed opinions about whether we negotiate with Republicans or whether we should just, you know, try to govern on a partisan basis and say, hey, the water's warm if you want to join. I think across the board, you're going to see that that all the people who run for president as Democrats next time will take a harder line view on Republicans, unless Republicans have changed by then, which seems unlikely.
Yeah.
And anyone who's like who tries to win the primary on a on a naive and antiquated platform of reaching across the aisle, blah blah blah, is not going to do well. That's my expectation.
Yeah, no. I think these changes might not happen as fast as we want, but I do like there's a lot of signs that these are in fact happening. And I think that's actually, I always like to end on a surprisingly optimistic note in these kind of dire situations. And I actually think that is like one sort of positive development that we can kind of conclude our talk with. So again, Brian, thanks for being on.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for having me.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.